Welcome to the Seattle Public Library's podcasts of author readings and library events, a series of readings, performances, lectures, and discussions. Library podcasts are brought to you by the Seattle Public Library and Foundation. To learn more about our programs and podcasts, visit our website at www.spl.org. To learn how you can help the Library Foundation support the Seattle Public Library, go to foundation.spl.org. The podcast you are about to hear was recorded in 2011.
Thank you so much for coming. It's nice to see everybody. I'm Jody Fenton, and I manage special collections here in the Central Library. We're located on levels 9 and 10. However, there is a very special collection on level 7, which is our aviation collection. It was built during the time that Boeing didn't have a library, and they sent their engineers up to Seattle and gave us money to help us build a collection that their engineers could use. We're happy to have Elliott Bay Books here. Today we have Peter Steckel, who is the author of Final Flight, The Mystery of a World War II Plane Crash and the Frozen Airmen in the High Sierra. This book was published in 2010 by Wilderness Press. He's also written Best Hikes Near Seattle and a mystery novel, and over 700 magazine and newspaper feature stories. Peter has a BA in botany from the University of California, Davis. He did graduate work in ecology at the beautiful campus on Humboldt State University and holds a secondary teaching credential in life science. He's worked as an educator, outdoor adventure guide, laboratory technician, botanist, and plant ecologist. And today he comes to tell us about some great research and a wonderful book. Peter.
Thank you. I want to thank everybody for coming this afternoon and sacrificing your lunch hour. So Final Flight is the story about a World War II U.S. Army Air Force's Beech 18 AT-7 Navigator that disappeared on a training mission November 18, 1942. Now, airplanes disappearing, soldiers dying during time of warfare is not an uncommon story, but I think Final Flight is a story uncommonly told, and I'll explain that as we go along. In August of 2007, I was up here on the Mendel Glacier in Kings Canyon National Park, and I was there with my regular hiking friend, Michelle. We were up there looking for wreckage of an airplane similar to this one. It's the Beech 18 AT-7 Navigator. AT stood for Advanced Trainer. It was used for navigation training. And we were up there looking for wreckage of the airplane, trying to figure out the story about the crew of four who were on the airplane when it disappeared. This is the pilot, William Gamber. Also on board was aviation cadet John Mortensen, aviation cadet Glenn Munn, and aviation cadet Leo Mustonen. And these three boys were in training to be navigators on the big bombers of World War II, the B-17 and the B-24. So looking through the official reports, I was able to learn a few things. For instance, the plane disappeared on the 18th of November in 42, the registration number of the airplane, 41-21079. They left from Mather Field in California. Crew manifest, and 5 years later, the crash site was found. The summer of 1947, four University of California Berkeley students were hiking in Kings Canyon National Park. They were all war vets. They were all combat vets. They were had their education interrupted by the war. They were going back to school, and they were taking the entire summer off to go fishing and hiking in the high country. And they were up here on the Mendel Glacier when they discovered airplane wreckage. So that was pretty interesting and exciting, but it was the beginning of their summer vacation, and they continued on their trip and pretty much forgot about it all until school was just about to start in September. They were at a fraternity party, and they were all talking about, oh, how did you spend your summer vacation? And they said, oh, there was that plane crash we found up on the mountains. So one of their fraternity brothers was in the reserves. He reported what he had heard to his superiors at Hamilton Field in Marin County, and the Army contacted the students and asked if one of them would guide some people up to the glacier to see if they could recover the bodies of any crew members. And so this fellow here, Bill Bond, took these two Army captains up to the glacier, and on the ice they found one of the engines from the airplane, and on the engine was a tag similar to this one, and on this tag it had the number 41-21079. So they were able to identify the wreck. Yes, indeed, it was the plane that had disappeared on November 18, 1942, with those four crew members on it. But it was late September. It was cold. Bill Bond was a mountaineer and a climber. He was prepared. I should show you that this is how Bill went up to the glacier. This is how the two Army captains went up, wearing their Oxford shoes. They had a pack in by on horse for, well, it was a two-day drive first to get to the trailhead, and then they got on their horses, and they had a ride all day, 25 miles, to a little snow survey cabin where they spent the night. And then the next day, they had a hike 3.5 miles up to the glacier through snow and ice over rock, and they spent 3 days getting there, and they spent 3 hours on the glacier because they just were not prepared for being there. But they did file a report, and they were quite emphatic that no bodies were recovered. So what the Army did was they went up again the next year. They sent this fellow, Roy Sulzbacher, to go up to the glacier. He made two trips. This is 1948. He made two trips up to the glacier to see if he could find the remains of the crew members. Now, Sulzbacher, during the Second World War, worked for Graves Registration Service, and he was a professional mortician before the war. He spent the 1940s during the war establishing cemeteries in the South Pacific following all the big battles there. So on his second trip, he was accompanied by these fellows, some mountain troops from Fort Lewis, and they had state-of-the-art shovels. They somehow had it in their mind that this big airplane, which would fit inside this building, just barely, they had it in their minds that the airplane was in one piece buried under the ice of the glacier. And they were going to dig down through the ice to retrieve the crew. Now, far be it for me to say that the ice of a glacier is as hard as this floor, and you're not going to have much luck with these short-handled shovels. But they did also bring in a gasoline-powered jackhammer. They thought they'd get through it that way. They also were not successful. And I think one of the reasons they were not successful is because they were unable to spend very much time up there. Turned out that Captain Sulzbacher was about to die. He was very ill. He had a disease called poliomyelitis. The bulbar type is the type that affects a person's lungs. And so those of us who are old enough to remember the 1950s and 60s, a lot of people they call them iron lungs, doing the breathing for people because their lungs didn't work anymore. I was actually able to get a copy of Captain Sulzbacher's death certificate, and that's how I discovered that he had died. And he had died, he had come home after a week in the mountains. I spoke to his wife, and she said he woke up the next day and he collapsed. He was taken to the hospital and he died. So he had just enough time to develop some photographs, but not to file his report. And I do know for certain that he and his crew in 1948 were unsuccessful in finding any of the four crew members from the missing airplane. So let's fast forward to October 2005. It's wintertime in the High Sierra. It's already snowed. It's cold. And there's these two fellows who have decided that they're going to climb here on the ice fields. Here's the bottom here. They're going to climb on this ice field, which goes up about 800 vertical feet. And they're up here on the glacier. This is a beautiful summer day. But on the day they were there, in late October, the wind was howling. It was snowing on them. It was hailing on them. It was just a degree or two above freezing. They're carrying their big heavy packs on their back, and they have their parka hoods over their ears because of the wind, and they see an object in the glacier, and somehow it didn't look like it belonged there. I mean, it's pretty serendipitous that amongst all the rock and the ice on this glacier that they would see something unusual. And when they got closer, this is what they saw. And what we're looking at are the remains of one of the four crew members from the missing airplane. This is the nape of his neck here. This is his back. And this canvas pack here with the numbers 1984 is actually a seat-type parachute, very similar to this one. And the 1984 is just the registration number on it, because you know the military, they got to have registration numbers on everything, keep track of things. So they decided not to do their climb. They hiked out to the town of Bishop in Eastern California near the trailhead, and they reported their discovery to the sheriff, who contacted Kings Canyon National Park, because they were in the national park. And after waiting a couple days for another few snowstorms to come through, the Park Service flew up in this helicopter with a crew of rangers, and they spent an entire day with ice axes and garden trowels and painter's brushes and all other sorts of small items, chipping away at the ice of the glacier to isolate the remains of this young man. They had to use those painter's brushes to brush away the snow to make sure they weren't leaving anything behind, like they found three fingernails that had fallen onto the ice. So they wanted to bring those back too. And after about 6 hours of working in sub-freezing temperature in the shade, digging through this ice, which is as hard as concrete, they finally had the remains isolated on an ice pedestal about 6 feet long and 6 feet wide, about 3 feet deep, weighing about 400 pounds. They loaded the remains onto the helicopter, and he was flown to Fresno, where the coroner spent a week defrosting the remains by pouring water over the ice, once again making sure that no part of the remains were lost. And then he was loaded into a casket and flown with full military honors to Hickam Field in Honolulu, Hawaii, which is where JPAC, J-P-A-C, which stands for the Joint POW-MIA Accounting Command, has their headquarters. JPAC's duty as a branch of the U.S. military is to find, recover, identify, and repatriate the remains of service personnel from mostly overseas, but in this case, from the United States. JPAC worked on the remains for about 5 months and were able to identify the remains as belonging to this boy, aviation cadet Leo Mustonen. And you know all that really sexy stuff you see on those CSI programs on TV, all that high-tech genetic testing and all this other kind of stuff for identifying people? JPAC uses that also. But in this instance, Leo didn't have any living relatives on the maternal side, blood relatives on the maternal side, so they weren't able to use any genetic testing. They ended up having to use the old-fashioned Sherlock Holmes-type deduction. They had a name, he had a name badge on his shirt similar to this one, and by looking at it under different colored lights, they were able to see the E and the O of Leo, the A for his middle name, Arvid, and the M from Mustonen. And they figured that, well, we have the genetic material from the other three boys on the airplane. It doesn't match with this unknown. We have this name badge, so this must be Leo Mustonen. But there were some questions, some really nagging questions in this story. The official United States Army Air Force's accident report from 1942 said the crash site was on Darwin Glacier. Leo Mustonen was found on Mendel Glacier about a quarter of a mile away. It also said that they had left from Mather Field, which is Sacramento, California, and they were on a training mission to Corning, California. Well, here's Mather Field near Sacramento. Here's Corning, about 150 miles north. And here's Mendel Glacier, about 150 miles southeast. Now, granted, they were navigation training students, but you would figure even a student would know the difference between north and south. The official report also said no bodies were recovered. Well, if that's true, what was this headstone doing at the Golden Gate National Cemetery south of San Francisco with the names of all four crew members, William Gamber, Ernest Glenn Munn, John Mortensen, Leo Mustonen? So that bugged me. I'd been working as a freelance magazine and newspaper feature writer for several years, so I got an assignment to write for a magazine called Sierra Heritage. My story was published in 2006, where I deal with all those questions. But I thought there were still some more answers that needed to be made, and so that's why I was up there with Michelle in August of 2007, up here on the Mendel Glacier. The plan was to find the airplane. The Park Service hadn't spent any time, and JPAC hadn't spent any time looking for the airplane in 2005, because it was October and it was cold, and they were focused on recovering the remains. I wanted to find the airplane and answer the question of why wasn't it found with Cadet Mustonen. To give you an idea of how big an area this is, we're looking at an area that's probably the width of two football stadiums, not the field, but the stadium itself, and then as long as maybe three football stadiums. It's a big area. Michelle and I, both being trained as scientists, had a very scientific way of doing our search. We're just going to walk in there and look around. And it was a good plan, because we found wreckage immediately. We found one of the front wheels from the airplane. We found the engine. Found both engines. This is the propeller hub from one of the engines. We found a section of the wing, and we found lots of little pieces, including fabric from the seats, piece of the fuselage all crumpled up like an accordion. And as Michelle was walking down the slope of the glacier, down what we call the fall line, looking for things that might have been spread down slope, I decided to traverse across the top of the ice, because I had my little GPS unit and I had the coordinates from where Leo Mustonen had been found in 2005. And my thought was I wanted to be at the site where Leo had been for over 60 years waiting to be discovered and contemplate what that meant. And as I was walking across the rock and ice of the glacier, I saw an object about from where I'm standing to the podium. And to me, at 12,500 feet, it looked like a little tree that had been killed by the frost, had turned black, and was kind of leaning over on a rock. And you see a lot of this in the high mountains, in the subalpine areas, where small trees get covered by snow for the entire winter long. They get attacked by this fungus, which kills the tree and turns it black. So that's what I thought I was looking at. And at this elevation, half the atmosphere is below you, so there isn't as much oxygen as you're accustomed to dealing with at sea level. And I'm getting to be an old duffer, and I was feeling the effects of being at that high elevation, so I wasn't really thinking as clearly as I do normally. Because if I'd been thinking clearly, I would have looked at this scene and said, well, can't be a tree. There isn't grasses growing here. There's no sedges. There's no wildflowers. There's nothing up here. There aren't even any insects. How could there be a tree there? And all these thoughts are going through my mind as I'm walking towards this object, and I get maybe 5 or 6 feet away from this object, and I see a gold ring. I know it's a gold ring. It's shining. It's reflecting the sun on the tip of one of the branches from this tree. And instantly I think, oh, well, there's a climber was here. He lost his wedding ring. When he got home, there was hell to pay. Some other climber following him found the ring, picked it up, slipped it on the tip of this little branch, knowing the first climber would come back, find the ring, all would be well at home again, and he would be sleeping not on the sofa anymore. And that's when all these things are running through my mind, and then it finally sinks in that, no, I'm not looking at a tree. I am indeed looking at a ring, and that I have found the remains of the second crew member from the missing airplane. So we reported our discovery to the Park Service, and they flew in and with JPAC. And about 6 months later, the remains were identified as this boy, Ernest Glenn Munn, known as Glenn to his family. I want to tell you something about how I got involved in this whole story, the story of what became to be known as the Frozen Airman when Leo Mustonen was found. It all started because I went to Boy Scout camp when I was 12 years old. It was a place called Camp Wolverton in Sequoia National Park in Southern California. And for a little 12-year-old kid growing up in Los Angeles, I had never seen trees this big. I had never seen a waterfall like this in my sweet short life. I had never seen scenery like this. In fact, on our backpacking trip up to this viewpoint, picture this little scrawny 12-year-old kid, probably weighs 40 pounds, carrying an 80-pound pack, crawling up the trail. I'm just so tired, I'm so exhausted, fingernails bleeding from dragging myself through the rocks and the dirt. And I get up to this scene, and I'm thinking, while I'm struggling up the trail, that I'm gonna die because I've never worked that hard in my life. And I get to this viewpoint, and I'm convinced I have died, and I've gone to heaven, because I'd never, ever seen anything like this before. And I fell in love, for the first time, with the Sierra Nevada mountains. And I've only had two real passions in my life. One are these mountains, and the other one is sitting in the front row. And so I spent most of my life trying to know everything I can about the Sierra Nevada mountains. I hike there, climb there, read about it, write about it. And based on all my experience, there were these questions that just wouldn't go away that I had to answer. The route, Matherfield north to Corning, how could they end up 150 miles southeast? If no bodies were recovered, why was there the group burial at Golden Gate National Cemetery? How could the frozen airmen be found on Mendel Glacier when wreckage was supposedly found on Darwin Glacier? And all the newspaper and television reports, and believe me, there were lots of them, all they did was muddy the waters. So in order to understand why it took so long for the frozen airmen to be found, it's important to know something about Mendel Glacier. So the first thing we need to know is that glaciers are shrinking. The ice in the glaciers is melting at a faster rate than it's being formed. And on Mendel Glacier, it's an unusual kind of glacier because it's what is known as a rock glacier, which means it isn't a bunch of rocks moving like a glacier. It means that it's an amalgam of rock and ice, kind of like Rocky Road ice cream. And the rock embedded in the glacier and the rock on top of the glacier actually serves to like a blanket to insulate the ice so it doesn't melt very rapidly, unlike the Darwin Glacier right next door, which is known as a clean glacier. So here's the Darwin Glacier. It's a clean glacier. The Mendel Glacier's right over here. A clean glacier is just like a big ice cube, and without that layer of rock in it and on it to insulate the ice, it melts very rapidly. And in the last 20 or 30 years, the glaciers in the Sierra Nevada, after all, it is Southern California, they're melting really rapidly. It's just that the Mendel is not melting quickly in comparison to the Darwin Glacier. A lot of the ice has disappeared between 1948 and 2007, and that's another reason why we had to wait so long for the remains of the crew members to be discovered. The glacier had to shrink. Now, as for the confusion of Mendel versus Darwin Glacier. Maps in the 1940s weren't very accurate. This is the actual topographic map taken by Captain Sulzbacher in 1948. From 1947 with Captain Lewis, who had made the initial report that they are on Darwin Glacier. And as you can see, Captain Lewis has circled Mount Darwin, because that's where he thought he was. He thought he was here, when in reality he was over here. So he was confused. Another reason why it took so long for the remains to be found is that this area is incredibly remote, which is not to say that it's difficult to get to. When I was a teenager, I could get there in a day. It takes me 2.5 days now, but I'm looking at things along the way. It's incredibly remote. The only reason people go up there, like the two climbers did in 2005, is to climb this icy slope known as the Mendel Couloir. Couloir is like a gully, and the ice only forms occasionally, and it's very steep. Down at the lower part of the slope, it's 60 degrees. At the top, it's nearly vertical, and it's about, 5 feet wide? The only people who go there to climb are really good climbers, and there aren't that many people who have the skill and technical ability to go there. So that's another reason why it took so long. The area is remote, not very many people go there. Now I'd like to tell you something about the boys, and you may have noticed this afternoon I've been calling them boys. In the 1930s and 1940s, that's what young men were called. They were called boys. And so that's why I call them the boys as well. I think like a lot of boys who grew up in that era, they were interested in airplanes. Airplanes were incredibly sexy in the 1930s and 40s, kind of like space travel became in the 60s and 70s. It was all four of these boys wanted to be in flying airplanes. I think a big reason why is probably because they grew up reading books and seeing movies about airplanes. They'd be Tom Swift. How many of us read Tom Swift? How many of us read Tom Swift books when we were growing up? The Dawn Patrol with Errol Flynn, a movie that talks about fighter pilots during the Great War. Maybe they saw Hell's Angels and they thought if they enlisted and became pilots, they'd get to meet somebody like Gene Harlow. I know I would. This is the pilot, Bill Gamber. It's a high school graduation photograph. I like to tell people, can you tell that Bill's dad was the town barber? Very well groomed. He grew up in a small town in western Ohio called Fayette. In high school and then in college, he lettered in basketball because Bill was tall. He was about 6'4". He was a straight-A student. He was active on the yearbook staff, and he played trombone in school orchestra, both in high school and in college. In fact, in college, he studied mechanical engineering. He got a four-year degree in engineering in 3 years, in an era before calculators, so I'm pretty sure Bill Gamber had to be a pretty bright kid to do so well. Also on board was John Mortensen. Mortensen was first-generation American. His family was from Sweden. They were farmers, and they lived in Moscow, Idaho, which is where he went to college. At age 25, he was the oldest of the four boys on board. Also on board was Glenn Munn. He was from eastern Ohio in a little wide spot in the road called Coleraine. And when I went to his funeral, the town is still a wide spot in the road. As Gertrude Stein said about Oakland, there is no there. There actually is no town. It's farms. Coleraine just happened to have a gas station, convenience store, and post office. And so that's how the town got its name. All the girls, though, in nearby Wheeling, West Virginia, where Glenn went to school, called him the Blonde Bomber. And he got that nickname from the friends of his little sister. Glenn was out of high school by now, and he would drive into town to pick up his sister, Lois, at school. And he was walking down the street, and there was Lois and her girlfriends over there, and all of a sudden the girls start giggling and jumping up and down, and Lois is kind of wondering what's going on. So she's telling me the story. So I didn't know what was going on. All my friends were acting so strangely after a while. And so I asked them what are you looking at? And they say, oh, look at him. He's just so dreamy. That's my big brother. She was so proud. And so the girl started calling him the blonde bomber after that. Like the other boys on the plane, Glenn enlisted before the war. He wanted to be a pilot. And he did his initial basic training in Southern California at the Santa Ana Army Air Forces base. It was an Air Force base that had no airplanes, which was okay because they also didn't have any hangars or runways, but it was an Air Force base. And when he and his buddies had leave time, they'd go out to the nearby Balboa Beach and hang out. And I always like to point out this guy as being the one out of the four who's out of uniform today. So while in Santa Ana, Glenn met and started dating a local woman by the name of Marilyn Dick. And after he disappeared, Marilyn lived until the mid to late 1960s. She never married. She never left home. She remained living with her mom until she passed away. And I always thought there was probably a reason for that, and it had something to do with Glenn disappearing. The fourth boy on board was Leo Mustonen. Leo was also a first-generation American. His parents were from Finland when Finland was not a country, when it was part of Russia. He was a quiet boy, but he played in the school orchestra. So I'm going to wrap this up with a few, some last thoughts about why I think the story is so important. I think it's important because it's the story of some soldiers who were lost within the United States. And like I said at the outset, it's not an uncommon story, but it is uncommonly told. When we go to school and learn about the wars our country has been involved in, or we see movies, read books, see documentaries, the focus is almost exclusively on what happened over there. And there isn't a whole lot said about what happened over here. And I think that's a shame. According to the U.S. Department of Defense figures, 16.1 million Americans served in the armed forces during the Second World War. Of these, 671,846 were wounded. There were 405,399 casualties. And of those casualties, 291,557 of them were killed in action, which leaves non-combatant deaths at 113,842, fully 28% of our soldiers who lost their lives during the Second World War were non-combat deaths. We never hear about that. And most of those non-combat deaths happened here in the United States. And to me, that's significant because I think there were not two fronts during the Second World War. There were three fronts. There was the European and North African front and the South Pacific front, for sure, and the third front, which is what I call the home front. Uncommonly told story. In fact, the Army Air Forces lost more than 4,500 aircraft in combat against the Japanese in the South Pacific. It's a big number, but when you compare it to what we lost in the United States, 7,100 aircraft were lost in the United States compared to the 4,500 shot down by the Japanese. And these were due to accidents in training, accidents in transportation, claiming the lives of 15,530 pilots, crew members, and ground personnel in over 52,000 separate, discrete accidents. 15,530 people. An uncommonly told story. And these are just four of those boys, not to mention the women who were also lost. And when I thought about it, it put to mind something I'd read, written by Robert Kennedy a long time ago. Now, he was talking about the Vietnam War, but I think the same thing can be said for this story in World War II. Here, while the moon shines, men are dying on the other side of the earth. Which of them might have written a great poem? Which of them would have cured cancer? Which of them might have played in a World Series or given us the gift of laughter from a stage or helped build a bridge or a university? Which of them might have taught a child to read? It is our responsibility to let those men live And I think it's also our responsibility to live our own lives with honesty and integrity to honor their sacrifice. So before I answer questions, I just want to briefly tell you about my next project. It's another book about military airplane crashes. It's called Beneath Haunted Waters. Just briefly, on December 6, 1943, two B-24 Liberators bombers left Hammerfield in Fresno, and they were lost over the Sierra Nevada. One wasn't found until 1955 in Huntington Lake. The other one wasn't found until 1960 in this lake high in the High Sierra called Hester Lake. These are the names of the crew members. The library is going to be podcasting this, and I see this as an opportunity trying to locate family members of these boys, hoping that if someone either here in the audience or someone who listens to the podcast hears the names, that they'll get in touch with me. The names are Charles Turvey, Robert Hester, William Cronin, Ellis Fish, Robert Bursey, Howard Wandke. They were on the Hester Lake airplane. On the Huntington Lake airplane was William Darden, Kulos Settle, George Berulik, Samuel Schlosser, Dick Mayo, Franklin Neiswanger, Richard Lee Spangle, and Donald Vanderplash. So if you know anything about these, please contact me. So that's it. I'll be happy to answer questions. Thank you for coming. Yes. So good question. Why was the plane supposed to be north 150 miles but found 150 miles south? The reason is that the official report was wrong. And I could give you chapter and verse on how I figured that out, but then you wouldn't have any reason to read Final Flight. Yes, sir. So was the plane off course? Another question that I dealt with, so his question is, what about the plane being off course? I don't think the plane was off course. I think that once I was able to accept that the official report that they were supposed to fly north was incorrect, it was really easy doing regular old Sherlock Holmes deduction to figure out what their actual course was. And so I think they were on course flying home when they encountered a weather event. But I won't tell you, because then you got to read the book. Yes, in the back. So the cause of death for the two boys who were found. The official JPAC report paraphrase is to the effect of death was consistent with, how did they put it? Well, a slow-moving airplane is rather humorous. A fast-moving airplane encountering a slow-moving mountain. So it was airplane crash. Every one of their bones was broken numerous times. Death would have been instantaneous. And for the three crewmen in the back of the airplane, they probably didn't even know what was going on. Yes. The position of the body that I found. He had been thrown from the wreck. He was on his knees, leaning against the rock, posed like this. His left hand crossed in front of his chest with his hand up, and that's why I was able to see his ring. In the ice for over 60 years in the glacier, still definitely recognizable as a human being. How did I viscerally feel when I realized it wasn't a tree and it was a person? I was happy because I knew that another one of the families was going to finally find out what had happened and that they would get their brother back. So I was very happy. But it's also continued to be a really emotional thing for me. Any other questions? There is a group called historyflight.org, which is negotiating with the Park Service to go up to Mendel Glacier next fall with cadaver-smelling dogs and electronic equipment to search the glacier to see if they can find the other two crew members. So that happens. It'll be in September of 2012. So I've got my fingers crossed for that. Thank you all for coming.
This podcast was presented by the Seattle Public Library and Foundation and made possible by your contributions to the Seattle Public Library Foundation. Thanks for listening.